Brian, can you tell me about the links that Halton has with energy being generated from the river?
Yeah, sure. The River Loon, which just flows on the southern boundary of Halton as a community, was first used for energy with a water mill in the 13th century. And evidence tells us that the use of the water has gone on from that time, leading through to the Industrial Revolution, when there were eventually six water wheels, and at the latter part of the 19th century, two electrical turbines generating power from the river.
And in the 20th century, did that energy generation continue?
It declined, and with the drop-off in the sort of oil cloth textile industries that occurred between the two wars, we believe generation from the last of the two electrical generating turbines ceased in the late 1930s or early 1940s, not quite certain which. But by the end of the Second World War, there was no industry left on the banks of the Loon in Halton.
So moving forward from that period to the present day, and one of the largest community-owned hydro projects, I think, in the country. Can you just tell me a little bit how that journey started?
It started not quite by accident, but from two sources. We went around a fairly lengthy programme of extending our community centre and wanting to put into that as much green energy technology as we could, and that was basically because energy prices were rising, the cost of running the hall was getting ever higher, and we wanted to grab an opportunity to put in better energy supplies at lower cost. So that was one of the strands. The other, which really was what brought the idea of the river as much to my attention as anything else, is we had an amazing village historian at the time who was at that stage, I think, in his early 80s. Sadly, he's passed away, but Bill Hosfield told me tales of this power generation that I've just related to you, and it seemed to me that we didn't want to reinvent the wheel, we simply wanted to put the wheel back on the cart. So essentially, after having done the community centre work, we then began to look at the river to see whether we could realise that potential again.
And so where did you, was there much interest amongst the community of actually engaging with this kernel of an idea that you had?
There was, for a number of reasons, and again, we're very lucky as a community to have had the amount of talent in the village that we've got. One of the things that happened when we were extending the community centre and putting all the green energy work into it was meeting another community of people who were interested in establishing their own eco homes, a passive house system. And Lancaster Co-Housing joined us on that journey in about 2009-10, planning their own housing scheme, and they were very, very keen to talk to us about the idea of developing the hydro. So the two sides met very happily by happenstance, really, and it was when we began talking together that we realised we had a skill set that was nicely matching. And one of the other strange coincidences was, in our own village and known to our own community, is a professional electrical engineer who's actually spent his entire working life creating energy stations in all manner of parts of the world and in the country, and he was happy to provide us with his expertise. And we also had a civil engineer whose lifetime's work was with United Utilities working with big water schemes, so he understood working with water. So all of those people were literally at our fingertips, and it just seemed a marriage made in heaven. We put our heads together on this project and really never looked back. So yes, we're absolutely delighted with what we've got.
And I suppose you've got the expertise, but then there's the financial aspect of the project as well. How did that develop?
It was a long and a slow road. In the early days, back in 2008-09, we started looking for small grants, and initially we found EDF Energy supported the first grant stage. Lancashire County Council gave a small amount of money for the second tranche, and then there was a third tranche came from our own district council, to the tune there of altogether something like £25,000, and that was enough for us to get feasibility studies 1 and 2 off the ground. it was enough for us to get the project to the stage of knowing that we had project definition, but we needed then some form of development money. And that was the point at which it became quite sticky. We found eventually a European fund that was happy to provide us with what we thought was going to be £500,000. And in fact, we actually shook hands with the minister in London in the Labour government of the day in 2010, January 2010. And we thought we had secured £500,000, only for the change of government in the May to actually whip that back out of our hands again, and it was back to square one. That took us into, I think, 2011, where we again had access to another round of European funding, supported by the government, and we applied for that, succeeded in getting it, only for wonderful George Osborne to decide that they were going to actually top slice all of the grant system at the time, and we ended up with, I think, only 304,000 instead of the £500,000. So all of this process was on the back of the knowledge that what we were looking at was a £1.4 million project. So we knew there was still a lot of money to raise. We looked at commercial capital, and there was anything from 7% to 18% annual interest costs attached to that sort of money. You can imagine that would have been almost impossible to sustain. In the end, we went back to raising local share capital, one of the very first, I think, attempts to raise capital for a green energy scheme. And we initially set our sights, when we still thought we were getting this grant funding, on £250,000 raised at £1 a share, and thought that that was a pretty tough target. We had no idea how successful we were going to be. We actually raised the entire amount out of share capital, and essentially the rest is history. The project is there.
And that was just from the local community, essentially?
Well, it wasn't entirely local. One of the benefits of the co-housing scheme was that they had access to the national green community, if I can call it that. So when our advertising went out, it actually went out throughout that community as well as throughout our own. I'm now secretary of the hydro company secretary, and I know from the share register analysis that about 50% of the share capital came from national sources, literally spread throughout the country, and the other 50% is local. It's based on our local postcode, so it's almost a half and half split.
And when the scheme was proposed, what reaction did you get from the local community?
Absolutely delighted. No issues at all. The only element of the community that was not in tune with everyone else was the angling community. You're probably aware that the Environment Agency is an agency that has two quite separate, distinct and conflicting hats. One is protection of the environment, and the other one was the promotion of green energy. And we had monumental battles with the Environment Agency. It took us all the way to the House of Commons on several occasions. Discussions with ministers, discussions with the chairman of the Environment Agency, attendance at conferences nationally, trying to make the claim that a hydro scheme on this river was something that was viable. The difficulty with it is that it is in fact one of the salmon index rivers for the country. It's one of three index rivers for England. The protection of the fish and the eels and the elvers and every other kind of marine life in the river is clearly a heavy requirement. We see that in our community as being just as important as the generation of power. Unfortunately, the anglers do not quite see it from our point of view. Their only take on life is the protection of what is effectively their sport. Sadly, we didn't come to blows, but we certainly were not in harmony for a very, very long time. We did eventually break the Gordian knot, and it took about 4 years for the Environment Agency to begin to understand what it was that we were proposing. We did finally get our licences granted in, I think it was the summer of 2014.
Was there support from your local MP?
That's an interesting one. Yes, there was. He actually, in fairness, introduced us to the minister at the time. He introduced us to the Lancashire group of MPs that we lobbied, because we were also working at the time with County Council, who had an office somewhere in the Forest of Bowland, who were at that stage trying to work out where all the potential sources of hydro in the county were. And they worked up, I think, 80 different sites that were capable of development. So there was a kind of a process of talking to one hat to find another, you know, there was a revolving conversation. All of which did lead us to MPs, ministers, Environment Agency, and so on. Yeah.
And then there's the development of the hydro, the installation. How was that a process that was smooth?
We actually built it ourselves. When I say that, we didn't physically put our hands in the water and pour rock out, but we project managed the entire scheme. Because we had the electrical expert, because we had the civil engineer expert, we were able to manage contractors ourselves to actually have the work done, to build the scheme, well, to design it in the first place, then to build the scheme, and then to commission it. So we have been very, very lucky. We have not had to outsource project management, design, operation at all. It's all kept in-house.
And the people, the experts that helped to that, you know, by pure chance were all in the area and could help to really drive this forward. Were these people that you were friendly with and knew before?
I'd met them all. The co-housing element, which were the sort of green community experts, I'd met through parish council work, because when they saw what the parish were doing, it was working with me at parish council level to get their planning permissions put in place on what was an old brownfield site. So from the parish point of view, it was a bit of a win-win. We really did remediate what was a pretty awful area that was in danger of becoming extremely derelict, and you know, vandalism and so on was taking place. So we cleaned up the riverside site. We put new passive homes in place. We've developed a hydro scheme, and we've got a reasonably harmonious community because we've literally worked together on it.
And on the community, has it, do you think it's engendered more community spirit amongst the people of Halton?
This was a dormitory village. People lived here, they drove out of it to go to work, and they drove back in the evening, and it really was a bit of a sleepy little hollow. The thing that's remarkable with the kind of synergy between regenerating the community centre, bringing co-housing in as a community, developing the hydro, and all the other bits that go along with that, mean that people no longer have to go out of this community to actually live, work, play. They actually do a lot of it here. There are a lot of people still live here and work outside, but an awful lot of the recreation now takes place in the village. An awful lot of the community cohesion is actually here. We've actually got two centres in the community now, where we didn't have a functioning community hall at all. We now have two locations which actually provide all the service needs, or the vast majority of the service needs of this community. So it's been a great benefit.
And back to that, on the hydro itself, what sort of generation are you getting out of it a year?
We've got notional capacity of 200 kilowatts, but you never achieve that. We have two turbines in there. The first one is 100 kilowatt rated, and it's quite capable of giving that, providing the volume of waters in the river. The second turbine is a kind of top-up turbine. When there's excess capacity above what the first turbine needs, the second one will click in, and it will provide additional capacity. The highest we've had out of that has only been 47 kilowatts, so we see that as being just about the maximum we can achieve. More realistically, on good days on the river, we can just see an absolutely deadbeat 125 kilowatts. So it's peaks and troughs of performance. Sadly, this is the 14th day when there hasn't been enough water in the river to generate anything. Well, there's been no rain up here for nearly a month now. The hills have emptied and the river is just sitting there. So I'm not operating today, sadly.
I think it's the driest winter that we've had in 20 years.
Yeah, I believe so, yeah.
Apparently, which is quite worrying.
I don't kind of see it that way. I think you have to look at the long-term averages. If you look at the amount of water that came down the river in 2015, you would argue that there has to be a sort of averaging out of the amounts that the river takes. Historically, we've got records going all the way back to the early 1800s. Bill, our historian, has got tales that tell of this river in flood. And there's a curious pattern in history as well. From what he expressed, it would appear that the first 20 years of any century are the years when you get the high waters, and then it all calms down and goes quiet after that. Now, whether that pattern's repeating and whether we're just at the start of the lower waters, it's very difficult to tell, but I think we need to be operating this scheme for certainly 10 years before we balance out the pattern. We have analysed the graphs over the last 30 years, and in fact the peaks and troughs indicate that where we're operating the turbine is absolutely the sweet spot for this river over the last 30 years. Hopefully that will continue over the next 30.
And was that historically where the generation took place over in the past as well?
The inlet leak that we use is the same leak that was used to power all the factories. That was one of the strange things. There was no evidence of the water power when I moved into the village 30 years ago, but this little rectangular leak entry was still there with the sluice gates, and it was obviously something had been there. And it was only the inquiring mind of saying, I wonder what that is, and then tying it into other things that people said, and then finally talking to the village historian that told the story. But the wonderful thing from our point of view was the Victorian, well, pre-Victorian weir, in fact, was still there. The inlet leak not only was still there, but it had actually been rebuilt in, I think, 1967 by Northwest Water, so it was in really good condition. And all we had to do was access that, start to take the water back in again, and the game was on. So we had a good starter.
And now it's generating enough electricity to power how many homes a year?
We think round about 300 on a really good day, but I mean that is entirely dependent on the energy consumption of the homes, which is, if you like, it's the balancing half of the equation, because we know why we're in trouble electrically. It's because people are consuming more and more and more power on an almost year by year basis, because everything we do is now powered by electricity. If only we could do the lowering of demand at the same time as raising provision on the green energy side, then we might balance the equation. But it is tough if people are going to continue to take more and more and more power to drive their homes.
Is that something that people have thought about more deeply since the development of the hydro scheme? Is this idea of connection with where the past, because this is where energy was generated in the past, and where they're actually, you know, in a way getting their energy from now, and the amount of energy they use, and how that can in turn develop some sort of behavioural change in people?
There is a small buy-in, but I don't know. I wouldn't say more than 10% of the community have got the message about energy consumption and trying to reduce it. I think there is a big message required, which informs people about just how they use power and how they might find ways of reducing that need for power. I think there are all manner of things in it. I mean, manufacturers need to make our smart devices even smarter. They need to be self-powering. If every smart device had a light meter attached to it that actually absorbed light and turned it into the few microvolts that are required to drive the device, then you wouldn't need to charge them on an almost every other day basis. That would help. It's silly things. I don't think that power generation on our roofs is as tidy as it might be. You've got solar panels on roofs, which all impact on the structural integrity of roofs. Now, my roof here is a slate roof. I wouldn't dream of putting the weight and the attachment brackets onto 80-year-old slates, otherwise I'm going to have to replace the whole roof. But if somebody suggested to me that I could replace the roof with solar-sensitive tiles, if somebody got round to designing those at a price that was worthwhile, it might be another step change in the journey of power generation. I think there are lots of things that haven't yet quite come to full impact in the green energy world. Still a lot to do, I think.
I was reading a piece the other day about paint on solar as well. So I haven't seen that.
Yeah.
I think, you know, if we look at, you know, where we've got to now with the development of green technologies and in the past few years, and where we could be in another 20 years, it's a really exciting time.
I think it is, that's right, yeah. But the early days of any new technology always find that it's expensive, therefore it's more difficult to sell, or the grant funding needs to be astronomical to actually make it justifiable. We need to make the breakthrough where it's actually mainstream energy provision, there is still a lot of work to do on that.
Do you think there's a role for that you have collectively to educate people about behaviour change in energy, given the fact that there is this energy source within the community?
There is a role for somebody. I mean, in retirement one runs out of energy to do everything, but I do not doubt that education is part of the problem. I think there is a big need for education. Who that should be in terms of doing it, I don't know. I'm not entirely certain about that, but I do recognise the need for people to be better informed.
And the wider benefits to the community from community generation of energy, is that something that you're starting to see here in Halton? Because the scheme's been up and running for how many years
now? We started generating in 14 on this one. We've had the sort of smarter energy technology in the community centre since 2010. That was a ground source heat pump, solar hot water and solar PV. So that mix and that understanding led to a little community group setting itself up. I can't remember its name now. It was one of those nice little catchy names. Halton Carbon Positive, I think it was. And there was there the kind of genesis of a group that actually tried to promote a little bit more in terms of educational awareness. We had articles in the Parish Magazine. We worked with an organisation in Lancaster that was a smart energy organisation. It led to quite a bit more PV going onto roofs in the community here. So we're kind of happy that at that level we were making success. They did try doing measurements of energy consumption by taking infrared photographs of homes and kind of seeing where the heat losses were. But in fact, that really fell on deaf ears. It didn't take off at all, and you know, the programme was kind of scrapped after a little while. I'm sure that there is more that might be done. I'm not sure that kind of at a parish or parish council level is the right organisation to be doing it. I think part of that is because it requires a level of expertise that the vast majority of parish councils simply don't have. It needs people with more knowledge to actually be not preaching about the need, but actually educating in the widest and broadest possible sense.
Through the hydro development, are you starting to see the benefits to other community projects that you're being able to invest some of the funds into?
We've done a not investing the funds especially. what we have been doing is providing advice to a number of other people who are considering putting energy schemes in. So we have advised other hydro schemes. The money itself that we've generated so far, I think in the last 2 years, something like £15,000 has gone into a trust that we've set up, a charitable trust, who specifically have a remit to invest within the parish. And they have been doing that. I don't think any of that's gone to further hydro use at all. Some of it's gone to fast high-speed broadband, but that's not quite the same. Not specifically into energy.
Well, it's the wider benefits that the community is.
It's a wider community benefit. Yeah.
And going forward, what are the plans for the hydro scheme? Is it going to be? Is it at its peak now? Is there room for another turbine?
No, we put a second turbine in, realising that the first one wasn't harnessing all that there was in the river.
Mm.
We now know, having put the second turbine in, that it's not going to pay the dividends that we hoped it would. We did hope that we would be able to run up virtually 200 kilowatts. That clearly isn't the case. And it is, it's a case of kind of using the volume of water that we're permitted to extract from our abstraction licence. We are having to work very hard to remain within the boundaries. I mean, we literally take every last drop that the Environment Agency permit, and very often, you know, the graph gets so close to the line of being fined and stopped that we do run a bit close to the line at times. On the top end, there just isn't any more water that we can abstract using the technologies we've got. I have actually just made a suggestion a week ago that one of the things that runs permanently and wouldn't be affected by an abstraction at all, because it doesn't take water, would be a thing called a Pelton wheel turbine. Our fish pass has a constant 1.5 cubes a minute flowing through it, and we could quite happily run a Pelton wheel 365 days, 24 hours a day, if we get permission for that. And it would probably only give us something like 8 to 10 kilowatts, but that permanently actually is quite good. So I don't know, it's minor compared to what we've already got, but I think there would be a benefit in doing it.
Mm. You think that might open up old wounds with the angling community, if you could?
Shouldn't affect them really, because I mean, I don't know if you know what a Pelton wheel is. It's a bit like a ladle on the end of a long arm, and there's several of them on the wheel, and all it does is catch the water and it spins round. The shape of it would really not impact any fish going upstream at all, and if there were any fish going downstream, then they'd be travelling at the same velocity as the water, and really all they would do is push the wheel round in front of them. So I don't think, my take on it, it is literally just a week ago, this conversation, my take on it is it wouldn't actually do any damage to the fish. So I'm kind of thinking I might put together a little cost-benefit exercise on whether putting a Pelton wheel in would actually pay any dividends or not. It may not, I don't know.
And for the ongoing maintenance of the scheme, is that something that members of the community are involved with?
Well, the turnover on a year, if the river performs as we expect it to, turnover is about £200,000. Out of that, about £130,000 is actually got to be set aside. Sorry, £70,000 has got to be set aside to actually pay back shareholders in the long term. £70,000 has got to be set aside for interest, because we have to pay interest. It's not 70,000, it's less than that. It's about £57,000. We're paying in interest to borrow that money at the moment, essentially. And there's about 30,000 or thereabouts that is literally annual running costs. We have to pay for new equipment, we have to pay wages to people who do the work, although there is a lot of volunteer work goes on as well. We do still have to pay for some expertise and some materials. So out of the £200,000, we don't end up with a huge amount that's profit. We originally were aiming at about £20,000 a year. The first 2 years we haven't achieved that, but it might get better as years go on, so we're hopeful.
Mm. And for your own relationship with energy, I suppose, has that changed over the time that you've been involved in the project?
I'm certainly more aware of the arguments we were discussing about earlier, which is that energy consumption in homes with new gadgets, new devices, only ever tends to increase. And I know white goods are getting slightly less consumptive of power, but generally speaking, homes, by the nature of what they are, tend to want to consume more power. And yes, I'm aware of it. I mean, for example, virtually all the bulbs in this house now are low energy bulbs. We had 8 spots in our kitchen when we modernised it 30 years ago, but these were 100 watts each, so you had 800 watts in there. If you go in the same display with new lights now, with LEDs, it's actually consuming 32 watts. So that's the sort of difference you can make if you're a little bit more thoughtful. And the cost on LED bulbs has just dropped very, very rapidly in the last 2 years. So, I mean, that's just one simple thing. More electrically, lower use of electricity in your devices at home, you know, A-rated goods rather than G-rated. So there are all kinds of things you can look at and do. And yes, I'm much more aware of things like that, yeah.
What if you look forward to the future, do you have a vision of how our relationship with energy will change and how we use it differs from today?
Well, I think we all have to try to change our view to a degree. The passive house is the ultimate target, I guess, where your energy consumption is effectively zero. You either create it yourself and use it, or share it with others and use it. But certainly the days when, you know, homes are constructed without a thought to energy consumption is something that I think really ought to be long in the past. The reality, of course, is that homes tend to last for hundreds of years. How you get older homes up to the standard that really we should be looking at, because it is literally heat loss is the biggest user of energy in the country. So if we can get over that one, and that's about insulation, but it needs clever techniques to insulate. There have been some sad examples, cavity wall insulation, for example, you know, seems to work in some homes, but in others it almost condemns the house. So we need to be smarter about how we actually help people to insulate their own homes as well.
And helping people and helping communities, is that something, have you had any outside interest in what you've been doing here and can, offering advice to other communities who are maybe looking at going down the same route that you have?
We have offered advice on the hydro process. I have informally offered advice on ground source heat pumps, which we are not at all enamoured with, I have to say. We've had big problems with ours to the point that it's now out of service. It's just not working at all. It was a design issue from the day one, which at the time we were not smart enough to spot. So architectural practices who talk the talk but don't walk the walk, engineers who think they see the next new thing and it's going to solve all the problems and they didn't know all the pitfalls before they put it into our project. There are all kinds of things come out of it, but it comes down at the bottom line, I suppose, to equipment being as good as it can be and people who market it and install it understanding it and being there to actually work through the problems when they arise. And we've found in many, many cases there are flaws right through that process. It needs a professional body who understands and can actually provide the sort of advice that we certainly didn't get.
And finally, just going back to the community here and the scheme, is there a way that you can educate the next generation here about energy generation as young families? Are they interested in what you've done here?
We're very aware that the team that actually designed and put this together have now sort of crept into their 70s. And I think we are very aware that we probably won't be here when it comes to the end of its useful life. So there is definitely that need. We are doing our best at the moment to introduce a younger group of people. Certainly the ones that I'm aware of are kind of nearer 40s and 50s than we are, who will perhaps take over the running of it and are getting involved in doing just that now. We have a duty officer scheme, or a duty operator scheme. Every day somebody goes down, has a look around, make sure there's no damage, make sure the system's working, and then we do a manual recording to back up all the automatic systems in case, for any reason, they get destroyed. So, yes, we're acutely aware of the generational need to hand on something like this to younger people. As for the education, I think it really needs younger people to be doing the educating. I'm perfectly happy to provide talks, as we do. We have universities visit, we have schools visit, women's institutes, interest groups, visit the Hydro almost on a weekly basis, and so we're happy providing education at that level. I don't personally mind, and nor does John, our electrical engineer, going and talking to other groups if they want an evening session or time during the day. We would be happy to do it, but it's very much, you know, for them to come to us. We're not actually marketing the fact that we're running this scheme. It's for people who are interested to find us, I think, really, at this stage.
And at the back of your lawn, and your beautiful location runs down to the river.
Yep.
Here, is it something you look at first thing in the morning to see the flow?
Well, I wake up with it when I open the bedroom curtains, so it's the first thing I see. I now have some idea where the river levels are and whether I need to actually interrogate it. We can interrogate it on the mobile phone. I send it a text message, an SMS, and it sends me one saying, "I'm fine, thanks, this is what I'm doing." So we're right up there with the technology in terms of controls. We can actually control it and set the controls. We can switch it off, switch it on, all from the mobile phone if we have to. We only do that if it's an emergency situation. Otherwise, one of us will just go have a look and sort it out. But yeah, very high tech.